Everybody, welcome to the In and After Show. It's me, Lindsay Loveridge, and with me is James Beckett.
Yo.
And as many of you may have noticed, YouTube is being freaking weird. So just wanted to let you know that that's not you or me. I thought it was me.
It's YouTube.
It's YouTube. So I saw some of you guys' chat before you got in here talking about like, oh, at least this is still working, or at least this is still here. And I want you to know that that made me really happy. So just to know that like YouTube looks weird, but you still figured out a way to be here for the live chat and to join us. So thank you very much for showing up every week to talk with us. Today we have an interview with Love Letter Studios, a rather new animation studio. They've worked on several anime, but what you may not know is that they are headed by Americans who founded that studio, Kennedy. So we'll be playing that interview here in just a second. And then we're going to talk about Oshinoko. James, did you get caught up?
I did. I'm caught up on Oshinoko.
And wow.
There's a lot going on.
You know what? I love Oshinoko. I always forget why, but the reason I love Oshinoko is because it's a soap opera. That's what it is to me. It's just drama. People being idiots, doing stupid conniving things, yada yada. So I'm just there for the drama. Oh, for those of you asking about my video, this is still my office and this is still the same setup. We've noticed that sometimes we take snippets from the podcast to make videos on social media. We had one go up today about the Trigun creator and whether he was Catholic or not. If you were here live, you already saw the conversation, but if not, if you go over onto our social media and stuff, we made a little clip out of it. And we've been noticing like my video quality is just not great. I regularly look very washed out. I am a very pale person in general, and my office is painted like a light pink color, and I have a window like right here that we have blinds on it now. And I mean, it's dark outside right now, but during the summer, you know, there's a window over here and then there's a light up there. And we were just trying to figure out how to get the lighting and everything in such a way that I didn't look completely washed out and kind of like I was here in 360p quality or something like that. So this is the same camera. What we did is fiddled with the settings a little bit in Camera Hub, because this is a that comes with this branded camera. But I also have two lights directly behind the camera right now, like shining in my face. I don't know why this worked, by the way. I don't know why that just didn't make me more washed out by having two giant lights shining at me. But I have one right here that's a big ring light that's in white, and then I have a smaller clipped on ring light right there that is set to like white yellow. It's to give my face color.
I mean, 90% of any cinematography is lighting. To get a halfway decent shot on any film, it's like 10,000 watts of ultra high beam, high grade lighting technology. So yeah.
So we have that now. And yeah, I'm a little more zoomed in, you know, I could, but that does give me the option of like backing away from the camera more. But I think all the additional light on me is now making it darker behind me, so it's easier to see me and things like that. So yeah, just, you know, let me know. Always an improvement, trying to get it to work without spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars on camera and audio and video equipment. Maybe I should move my mic right center too.
It's 2026. I don't think you're allowed to make money unless you spend several thousand dollars on video production equipment.
Yeah, and a lot of times it's not covered. So it's just out of pocket expenses. James, I'm just noticing your controversial subtitle take, which is reference to Emerald Fennell's Wuthering Heights is good, actually.
Yeah.
I have not seen it yet. I'm a low-key Emerald Fennell defender. I liked Saltburn a lot. I liked Promising Young Woman enough. I enjoyed both films. My only knowledge of Wuthering Heights, the situation, is entirely via Reddit. From your Blue Sky post, I've gotten the sense that this interpretation is pretty much wholly original from the book.
Not wholly. The way that Emerald Fennell has described it is that instead of adapting the book, she is adapting like her 14-year-old self's memories of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So in like the broad strokes, mostly it's recognizable as Wuthering Heights in a very loose sense. I would say like it's more Wuthering Heights than The Lion King is Hamlet. Let's just say that.
Okay.
Right? Lion King is still pretty recognizably Hamlet if you know the story and all that.
Yeah.
It's the same character, same setting. It's definitely not trying to be the book insofar as it's very horny. and completely deranged in its costume design and set design and a lot of its characterization. The thing I've been comparing it the most to experientially in regards to like a story that doesn't really get the intended thematic undercurrent of the story, but I think it captures what society has made of the story in like the hundreds of years, is the Baz Luhrmann and Romeo and Juliet with Leonardo DiCaprio, Claire Danes. That story also takes like a bloody sad tragedy about how dumb and impulsive teenagers are and turns it into like a sappy romance that's like very much romanticizing what the audience was meant to see as really needless and sad and frankly kind of stupid. And this is definitely taking a messed up, complex story of like generational trauma and abuse and turning it into like a just a toxic, messed up romance.
Okay.
But if you're okay with that, which I am, I don't really have much love for the Brontes. And as far as I'm concerned, if a story is any number of centuries old and has a dozen adaptations already, you can kind of do whatever you want with it. That keeps it from getting boring. If you're down for a movie that will like make your eyes bleed from how gorgeous every single shot is, then I highly recommend it.
Again, I have not read the book and have yet to see the movie. So all I've seen on social media as far as like criticism that made some sense is, of course, the casting of Jacob Elordi as Heathcliff, who is a character in the book who's often described as racially ambiguous, but definitely not appearing the same as the, it takes place in England, right? As like the white English folks in the film. And people have extended that as a criticism of Fennell's approach to filmmaking in general, as far as like maybe not understanding certain themes or whatever. I find it hard to believe that a director would make a film based on the book and be completely ignorant to this point. So I feel like it had to be a deliberate decision.
Not only that, but several key characters of the book have been cast as actors of color. Nelly, one of the supporting characters, is it Maggie Chow, the woman from The Menu? She was the supporting chef, the kind of secondary antagonist. And then I don't know the name of the actor, but a Middle Eastern actor was cast as the conventional love interest.
Oh, okay.
His name's Edgar, and he's like kind of the white bread, nice, sweet, far too trusting husband. So to me, I almost read it as, because for as much as I think Wuthering Heights was trying to like say something about the way that marginalized people were treated in England, it is also a 200-year-old book. And there are definitely—
I can't believe books are that old. I mean, yes, I can. It's just also that like books from that time period are that old now is something that has caught up to me. So
Hong Chau, thank you, is the name of the actress that plays Nellie. But you can definitely read some of the book's characterization of Heathcliff as his, for lack of a better term, savage nature sort of being contrasted against the more meek and innocent, or not innocent, but the more civilized attitudes. And it's not that simple. I'm oversimplifying it, but that's there, right? And I think the fact that there are several supporting characters that are non-white, and now all of Heathcliff's, let's just say, problematic characteristics are very much just rooted in his relationship with Kathy. I think it was maybe an attempt to sort of avoid any possible we are exoticizing or fetishizing non-white people for their beastliness or their... I can see how it might have made sense in the casting director and in their heads. So,
Yeah, that makes sense. I'll watch the movie and like make my own judgment on it as someone who hasn't read the book. Before we transfer over to this interview that Jackie did, I do want to talk about a book that has nothing to do with anime or manga. It's just an audiobook I'm listening to that I'm enjoying a lot. Folks, please check this one out. It's called Witchcraft, A History in 13 Trials. It came out in Britain last year. It was a national bestseller in Britain last year. Oh my God, it's such a good book. So it starts, you know, it travels through history and it's just looking at specific trials that were witchcraft trials at the time. People most famously know Salem, of course, but that one actually I think they spend the least amount of time on, but wholly put the focus on Tatuba, the enslaved woman who was central to that case, and kind of delve into like her history, her lineage and things like that, because so much of that is glossed over. It seems very likely that she was South American native, and they kind of get into like the etymology of her name and things like that. But the other cases are ones that I haven't really heard of. I mean, there's the very early ones in Germany and France where the Hammer of Witches book came out of, but there are some later ones that I didn't know about that are really fascinating, including another one that was in France in the early 1900s.
Are you talking about the nuns? Or rather the priest?
The creepy cult priest. And the girl, her name was Marie Catherine. And her basically coming out after kind of getting away from him long enough to say, no, this was like a sexual assault case. And that all went to trial.
Was that the Devils of Loudun? That's like the, I think like the name of like the story, not the fictional story, but that's like what people call it. Like the, I think Loudun was where it was at.
Oh, that doesn't sound familiar to me, but it's possible that might be another one that's from a similar time period or something. Ooh. 'Cause there are quite a few and she only gets to 13, but the one I just finished is about a murder that took place in the Pennsylvania Deutsch community in the 1920s that involved men, actually, who I didn't know that the Pennsylvania Deutsch community basically has a, they wouldn't refer to it as witchcraft, but like basically folk magic. And in a lot of these cases, the magic is ingrained in the Christian beliefs, so they don't see them as contradictory to one another. And one guy was allegedly bewitching another guy, and he thought that's why he was having mental health issues. And so him and two other men break into his house, or they're invited into his home, but they killed him. Oof. And then it goes to trial. So that was interesting because I didn't know that people were still practicing anything like that in the United States at the time. I knew about the spiritualism movement, but just didn't know anything about this area. And then the next one that I've most recently finished is about spiritualism movement and a British woman who ended up on trial for witchcraft based on like a 1700s era law in Britain.
Oh, because
she successfully predicted or stated that a naval vessel had sunk before it was public knowledge in one of her seances. And the government was like, wait. I mean, it was a hoax. You know, this was one of those ectoplasm seance things.
Blowing balloons and all that stuff, yeah.
Is this ship sunk? Only has two answers. And in this case, she answered correctly. But
and lots of boats were getting sunk at the time, famously.
this is World War II. Yeah,
famously a time of a lot of sinking boats. So odds are not bad.
There's a Winston Churchill quote about it where he's basically like, the fact that we're having a witchcraft trial right now is nonsense, or whatever he happened to say at the time. But yeah, people are talking about YouTube outage, and that does make me wonder if this stream is like, you all can see us, right? We exist, even though YouTube is being weird. I hope you're all like, so Neon Icy, it's not a series of 13 books, it's a single book that just covers 13 different trials. Matt, 1-5 quit making the same prediction. Okay, so yeah, that's just a book I'm reading right now. Everyone should check it out. I'm audiobooking it while cross-stitching, which is what I'm going to do immediately after the stream because I'm almost done with the cross-stitch thing I've been working on off and on for like 5 years. So it's very large.
Ooh, so this is a culmination.
Yes, so I'll show you guys when it's done. But right now we're going to pivot. We're not going to play the whole interview. It's a 22-minute interview. The whole thing will be up on YouTube shortly after this. We'll get it up this week. But I'm going to go over to Jackie Jing interviewing Love Letter Studios about their history of working on anime. So give me just a second.
Anime News Network here, and right now I am chatting with some incredible people. I am so happy to introduce Kennedy Freeman, the owner of Love Letter Studios, voice actor Lakaira Porter, and animator Jenna Monet. All right, so you guys have incredible career histories. Can we start off with you all telling everyone who you are, what you do, how you got to this point? Break it all down. Kennedy, why don't we start with you?
Hi, everyone. As you know, my name is Kennedy Freeman. I started Love Letter about 3 years ago now. Actually, it's the anniversary because it's February. So yeah, when I started it originally, the goal was for us to make our own originals. I guess I can start off with my journey. I first started it at DreamWorks as an intern back in 2021. And once I graduated, I went to Disney TVA again as an intern, but I worked for Monsters at Work in Alice's Wonderland Bakery as a prop designer and a storyboard artist for both shows while doing my internship. Quickly moved on to doing my own originals, and that's when Love Letter slowly started to become what it was. And as I was doing that, I told myself I wanted to work in anime, and so I got a chance to network with a few people. I did a little bit with Tenari at first, and when I went to Tenari, I decided to branch out and do my own thing. And that became us working for Hanako and a few other projects. And pretty soon I was able to bring in my team that was helping with our originals. And slowly but surely, we managed to work on about 50 productions for anime companies and studios.
Hi, everyone. So my career started off as a voice actor, and that's what I do. I do freelance on that's my main gig. And I'm a very prevalent voice actor in the indie space. I'm in a lot of indie animated projects online floating around. Maybe like there's a couple series like Animation Station, Towards Galaxy's End, which is by Love Letter, Lacey's Webisodes, a lot of underrated indie animated series. And then of course I met Kennedy back in like 2023, and she brought me on as a voice actor for her show Towards Galaxy's End. And I just, you know, built a connection with Kennedy, and I decided to help her out with marketing and social media. And we started a podcast called Towards Galaxy's End, or Towards a Podcast for Towards Galaxy's End, to promote and help bring in more viewership. And then she brought me on as a production manager as well. And here I am.
Hi, I'm Jen Namane. I graduated from SCAD about a year ago, but I started working at Love Letter also in 2023 as a cleanup artist on Towards Galaxy's End. And I kind of just started animating and working with them more often. Then once I graduated, I started working with them on anime projects and as a PA and a bunch of stuff. So glad to be here.
We're happy to be chatting with all of you. It's really cool to hear everyone's history and how you all got brought together through this amazing studio. Kennedy, I really want to pick your brain. Could you talk about working in the animation industry in Japan as a foreigner? I think myself and our executive editor were like, wow, this is crazy that this like bridge is being created. And I don't know if it was difficult or how you navigated all that.
It still is a learning curve, truthfully, because I'm still learning Japanese. I would say my Japanese is bare bones. However, due to networking and getting a chance to talk with a few of the producers that I knew while I was at Tenari, and then going to Annecy and learning about their companies, they were able to help me out with trying to get more work through their other studios. And while that was happening, I wound up connecting with more and more PAs and producers outside of them to try to get more opportunities. Luckily, a lot of the studios that we work with have been accommodating, to which if I have to do a meeting, they'll have a translator on hand for me, or they'll have the notes ready so that way I can just go ahead and translate it and figure it out from there. But trying to navigate what's needed further west compared to the east has been definitely not the easiest thing, since it's what we need in the West and what we need in the East are completely different in terms of animation.
I was wondering if maybe all three of you could elaborate on that. You said like there are some differences in your respective roles for Love Letter. What I guess differences have you noticed? Jenna, have you noticed anything when it comes to animating, or has it been relatively the same?
When it comes to animating, I think because a lot of people in Japan animate on paper still, there's like different processes that go into making sure that your files are set up to where somebody who works on paper and somebody who works digitally, like they can both still work together and it still makes sense. Timesheets, never had to fill out one of those before working on anime. Love those a lot. But I think in terms of how it's different from working in the rest, it's kind of weird because like it's like the entire process is different a little bit, because like in the West you have like you have your layouts and you go to rough animation, then you go to clean up and da 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 da. But anime, they have Genga layout, then Sakon, then Negan, then blah, blah blah blah. And I'm just like, wow, that's interesting.
What about for you, Lakaira? Have you noticed any differences? I mean, also you're doing social media management, but also voice acting. So I'd love to hear from both of those aspects.
Okay, for me personally, there are big differences. It's just for me, I'm jumping in straight. This is my first production manager job in general. So I'm just introduced to the Japanese side of production. So I don't particularly have that much experience with how things are done in the Western. So it's interesting when I do get the shot at, you know, doing production manager work for a Western animation, I'm probably going to be like, whoa, this is a lot different.
Kennedy, why did you decide to found this studio? Is that the right word? Find the studio. Sorry. Why did you decide to be the founder of the studio? And tell me about the name too, because I read a little bit about the background and I thought it was really interesting.
Yes. So when I created the studio, I did want to protect my own like original projects that we're working on. Like we've mentioned, we're working on Towards Galaxy's End right now. But as I started doing more and more work, I realized that a lot of people were also having trouble finding jobs in the West. And so as I was continuing to get more opportunities, I was like, okay, well, let me see if I can get a few studios to trust us enough to let my team work on these projects as well. So we started building up from the people that I knew and then who they may know and bringing them on so that way they could have a bit more experience and job work under their belt. Since, you know, a lot of the jobs nowadays, they're just like, oh, well, you need to have this much experience. Or you need to have this much. Well, now they do. So hopefully that gives a lot of the people that work under us a bit of a leg up. Hmm. But in terms of why I call it Love Letter, my handle on social media ever since I was like in high school was Kinsey Love with the L-U-V. So I kind of see animation again as like, it's a love that I have. So I said, okay, well, why don't we just call it Love with the L-U-V and then a letter and treat it as like a love letter to animation.
I love that. So cute. And then I want to ask Lakaira and Jenna, why did you think it was important to be a part of Love Letter? Was there anything that really like drove you to be like, oh, I really, really want to be a part of this? Lakaira, we can start with you for this one.
To me, I wanted to be a part of Love Letter Studio is I think that Love Letter gives accessibility more than anything for animation and people who are like me, a person of color, and just spreading that love for animation and showing people that anyone could get into this field of work. And I just thought that was really special and I had to join the movement, you know?
For me, I initially joined Love Letter working on Towards Galaxy's End because, you know, I like magical girls. I feel like me personally, I was just really interested in working on something like that because it's just something that I've always enjoyed and thought was cool. So,
oh, I love that. And, you know, we are all women of color here and face many struggles. So I did want to ask you all about the adversity that you've all faced throughout your career.
It's interesting because I've seen a lot of stuff already, even just from being like an intern at DreamWorks or going to being a PA at Titmouse. Like you see a lot of stuff with how like there's not a lot of Black females that might be in like those bigger roles, or like there might not be a lot of like Hispanics or like anyone who's like a person of color. Like it's really hard to see that type of diversity in animation. And so even with working in Japan, Japan doesn't necessarily care about like the whole diversity and like their creatives. They more so just want you to be able to do the work, and they trust that you'll be able to do it if they're hiring you, which has been nice. It's always interesting to see like what they may expect if they see me when I turn my camera on, because like my name doesn't hint that I'm Black, but it's always nice to know that like I can still do work and they're just like, well, we hired you because we know you can do it.
Yeah, I feel like just in general in animation, you don't see people who look like me at all in animation, really, especially being Muslim and a woman and Black and all that other stuff. Like, I feel like you don't see me in animation. And like, especially growing up, I was under the impression that I would probably never get to work in anime. Or like when I was especially younger, I didn't think I would ever get to work in animation. But like, I feel like people in my life kind of pushed me to like not think that just because I look a certain way or because I identify as something that I can't do the things that I dream and want to do.
I deal with adversity all the time, not only in voice acting, but as a production manager at a, you know, an anime studio. So there's always people talking, you know, but as a voice actor, you would think this would be a career where like that shouldn't even matter because you're behind the mic anyway, but it always just seems like you have to work twice as hard as your, you know, your counterparts in this field of work. But you know, that's not gonna stop me.
What helped you all the most when pursuing your career?
Definitely my family and my friends. Anime does not pay a lot, and even trying to like just get work for like the West as well, like it's been very challenging because like I don't know how much you're aware of like the current circumstances of like animators in the US, and just like a lot of people are out of a job right now. And so if it wasn't for like my family and my friends has been helping me out, like I don't think I would still be able to do animation, because at this point it's like you have to find something else to sustain yourself. But because everyone's been helpful, again, Love Letter team, if it also wasn't for them with like their hard work and stuff too, like I don't think we would have grown as big as we have.
My friends and my family Especially a big shout out to my dad, because after my mom passed and he found out that I wanted to get into voice acting, he kind of just went all in. He helped me build my vocal booth and everything. It's very important to just have your family and your friends close, because whenever you have, you know, your bouts of imposter syndrome or just self-doubt in general, they're always there to help pick you back up. And my family at Love Letter.
Oh, yeah. Well, shout out to the friends of the family. Shout out Professor Zona. Oh, my goodness. That's my queen. But yeah, I feel like we would not be able to do this without the people in our lives, you know, keeping us going, because animation, good Lord. Oh, my gosh, these rates.
That's an excerpt from our interview with Love Letter Studio. They're a really inspiring group and great to talk to. If you're not familiar with them, you know, please check out their YouTube channel. You can put Towards Galaxy's End into YouTube and pull up their pilot project that they're working on right now. It looks super cute. A magical girl focused, you know, give them a like, give them a follow. They're up and coming, so I'd really like to support them.
Absolutely.
And see what else that they managed to accomplish. Yeah. Look for the full interview on our channel here by the end of the week.
Awesome.
All right, James, are you ready to talk about Oshinoko?
So much drama.
So much drama with Oshinoko. So this will have spoilers up to the latest episode released. If you're not caught up on Oshinoko, please come back after you have. Or if you don't care and want to hear all the spoilers and then go watch it and react on your own, you know, go ahead. Stay here, I guess. Just giving you that option. We are in season 3 of Oshinoko, the anime adaptation based on the manga by Aka Akasaka, the creator of Kaguya-sama Love is War, and art by Mengo Yokoyari. I'm doing this off the top of my head. I hope I got their last name right. Who's also the mangaka behind Scum's Wish, which is another series to go check out if you like messy drama stuff like this, right? Goodness. Where we last left our trio of, well, it's bigger than that, but I guess Aqua, Ruby, and the secondary characters coming in there. I mean, Aqua thought he'd figured out who his dad was after connecting with a half-brother. And they both have the same DNA, and that half-brother told him, oh yeah, well, you know, my dad's dead. And so he was ready to just sort of move on. You know, there's no revenge to be had because the dude's already dead. I can kind of focus on my life as a up-and-coming talent. You know, he's appearing on these Japanese talent type talk shows.
They really do love variety shows, don't they?
Yeah, they do. We don't really have an equivalent of that.
Not anymore. We did like in the 70s.
Yeah, it was like, what was I thinking of? Closest thing I remember kind of being like that in the 70s was like Hollywood Squares.
Cher had hers.
The Sonny and Cher show, Carol Burnett show, you know, the ones that maybe mix comedy. And then the ones that were more silly, I was thinking it was like Hollywood Squares or Match Game.
Yeah.
Where they kind of had a stable of celebrities that appeared. It's similar in Japan where there's certain talent types that like are reoccurring on the show. The closest thing I've watched this, I mean, they have them in Korea as well. And so if you've ever watched A Chef in My Fridge on Netflix, which is basically a variety program of chef personalities, and they do cooking and stuff on it. So there's that too. But the chefs are all popular contestants, second, first place winners from culinary class wars and other Korean like cooking competition shows. He's got a role on those. Ruby is really taking off in her idol pursuits, and that's helping push the B Komachi team up. Kana is not over the fact that Aqua is dating, oh, what's the blue-haired girl's name?
Akane. I know, Kana and Akane, it gets a little confusing.
Yeah. She's not quite over that. Maybe Aqua actually loves Kana more, but Akane, like, knows he's cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. She knows all of his drama and stuff going on.
She doesn't know he's reincarnated, right? She just She just knows he's out for murder revenge.
Yeah. Okay. She just knows he's out for murder revenge, and she's been, like, very accommodating, understanding of his, like, PTSD anxiety episodes related to that. And, you know, things are just moving along, but the biggest twist in the last couple episodes is Ruby is becoming a sociopath, and maybe Aqua was wrong about the guy who is his dad.
Yeah. It's been a roller coaster ride.
Yes, it's definitely been a roller coaster ride. I guess focusing on Aqua first. Okay, so right now the current theory is that the guy that Aqua thought was his dad isn't him, because he also wasn't the other guy's dad either. This would mean that both I and the other guy's mom slept with this third person. So that would mean he's still alive. And Akane thinks she knows who it is and is going to take care of it without Aqua finding out. But I don't think her current theory is right for some pretty screwed up reasons, right? She thinks it's this other idol that was actually a year younger than I, that it was this guy that I was, now I haven't read the manga, guys, so like no spoilers, but there was another up and coming idol at like a workshop type camp with I, who was a year younger than her. And that would mean that if he was the father, that Aqua and Ruby were conceived when he was 15. So in Japan, that would be, it's the equivalent of a freshman in high school for the American school system, but it's ninth grade. I guess we should just say that. So he would have been in middle school. But that would also mean that if he was the dad of that other guy, that happened when he was 11.
Yeah.
Has anyone stopped to think that maybe it's not him and it's his dad? That makes more sense to me. I mean, I guess it's not impossible, but 11 is like precocious puberty, sort of.
It is. This is where I actually have to exercise some restraint, because this is one detail of the story that I was spoiled on by a completely different party unintentionally months and months ago. I didn't know the context. I didn't even really remember what was happening until recently. And so I will say no more in either direction. But I think more important than whether or not it's true, I think the comment that got me was, I think it was Akane who said it, that was like, well, this kind of stuff just happens in the entertainment industry.
Yeah.
If nothing else, I think because so much of the season is about how young women are exploited, and women in general, but specifically younger women in this industry are exploited. I think the fact that this is even on the table as like maybe a twist or a reverse twist or a reverse secret double twist or whatever,
is
just, it's another avenue for the show to explore the industry. Predilection towards taking advantage of anyone that is vulnerable or anyone that is put in positions to be taken advantage of. I just thought it was crazy that when Akane thought that theory up, she didn't immediately throw it in the trash. Her first thought was, well, you know, we're in the entertainment industry. And I was like, oh my God. Okay.
Yeah. While we could say that under the best circumstances, like I and Hikaru is the name of her co-actor that was in the group. I mean, it could be just a really sad, unfortunate teenage pregnancy situation, a 15, 16-year-old getting together. It happens. I've known it to happen. I've known people it's happened to. But in the situation of if he was 11 and this presumably grown woman, like, I don't know. That's just abuse. Yeah. Like, there's no way around that. That's like, you know, it's weird. It's messed up. Like, I have a 9-year-old, he'll be 10 in June. So like, whenever these sorts of story beats happen, it becomes very different when you have like a real life point of reference, as I'm sure you do, James, just from work.
Yeah.
So it's like being 15 or being 11 isn't like just sort of like a character idea. Like, I'm interacting with someone in that age group every single day.
Yeah.
And the very concept is so fucking gross and weird. It's just,
for whatever issues I might have with Oshinoko and the way that it does its story stuff, I do find it very commendable and engaging the way that it's very directly confronting a lot of the unspoken or under-examined harm that is done to people, not just in the entertainment industry, but specifically in Japan's entertainment industry.
Yeah. I mean, this is like, Johnny's. This is just Johnny's, guys. Like,
exactly. Not... When you just said that, I always say that the thing that I find so funny about anime is I've had to learn to not even think of them as like as kids. Because whenever they say, oh, so-and-so is 14, I'm like, no. I work with 14-year-olds literally every day. No 14-year-old has ever been like this.
Yeah,
These are like little 20-year-olds walking around in high school uniforms.
Yeah, in uniforms.
But also, like, how often are young characters, and again, usually women, but not always, young characters who are young presented in like, you know, sexualized ways? It's really just not addressed, or like, you know, it's just played as like a trope or whatever. And so the fact that, I mean, really, that any anime would address a possible instance or a scandalous instance of abuse, or in your example of probably inappropriate or unfortunate sexualization. When does that happen? When do any anime characters ever talk about like the age of consent or sex education or actual healthy relationships for young people to have? Like, that never comes up.
It's pretty rare when it does. It's always kind of refreshing almost when there's something direct like that. I mean, both in terms of sexual consent or sex ed, or there have been certain series lately. There was an episode that aired recently where the subtitles deliberately referred to someone as neurodivergent.
Oh, that was a Journal with Witch, I think.
Journal with Witch. And it's just like, oh, okay, yeah, we're not just watching a fantasy world all the time with characters playing in it. LFR said Johnny's who.
Oh, man.
it's a big story, so it would take me a long time to explain all of it.
Yeah.
But there's lots of articles on Anime News Network. This broke last year or the year before. Johnny's, it's not even called that anymore. They changed their name for reasons that'll be obvious in a moment, was a huge talent industry in Japan, specifically or most commonly for male idols. And these included like boy bands in the same way that we're used to have morning musume and stuff. And so there would be junior idols. And so boys would start in like middle school-ish age, work through high school, get into, you know, adult. And that was how you launched an idol career, was through Johnny's. And they had lots of contracts with movies and stuff. So if you signed on with their idol agency, sometimes you weren't just singing and performing music. You would also get acting gigs, all this other kind of stuff. And it was named after its founder, Johnny Kitagawa, who is dead and was found to have sexually abused, I'm going to say hundreds.
Probably hundreds, yeah.
Of boys. Over the course of running that agency, it was very much an Epstein type situation where people were facilitating his ability to do that. It was known within the agency, things were covered up. There were, you know, some idols tried to blow the whistle and it was sort of swept under the rug, or maybe there was a payoff or something like that. And so not long after his death, there was kind of a huge uncovering of this. They had to hire a third party agency to supervise. They've renamed the entire agency at this point. I think the Kitagawa family is not even directly running it anymore, because once he died, it went to like his niece and then yada, yada, yada. So it was a huge, it just kind of blew the lid off of it.
Yeah.
So
for any UK listeners, not dissimilar to the Jimmy Savile thing, except at least to my knowledge, there wasn't as much of like a massive industry conspiracy level. He was just like a predator. I mean, there were people that helped him out, but it wasn't like he didn't have like a whole company that just, well, I guess.
Yeah, I guess actually, he did.
No, he did, actually.
Yeah, he did.
God. Okay. Well, yeah.
Yeah. So when I refer to, you know, this is Johnny's all over again, that's a reference to Johnny's. That's what I meant by that statement. So yeah, I mean, it's possibly true. I mean, I guess it's not difficult to believe that that abuse took place within the Oshinoko story. I guess I just find it shocking that there would be a pregnancy. The closest thing I can think of to that is that horrible teacher who did something similar.
Oh, God. Yeah. God.
She got very famous for
it. Oh, she did. Yeah. In my line of work, that's like the first story you're ever told of like, here is, I mean, I find it funny is not the right word, but the joke, I guess, or the comment that we almost always make is the ironic thing is so many of us have to sit here every year. We have to do, you know, abuse training and all that stuff. And we have to get reminded of all the things not to do, which really just boils down to don't touch the children in any way.
just don't
put your hands on them. You know, just don't do it. But we always remark, like, the funny thing is, and the sad thing is that no one in this room needs to hear this unless they're the kind of people that are already probably going to do bad things, because I don't think a seminar was going to stop
them. It's going to stop them, sure.
But that one is awful, because then she, like, tried to, anyway, I'm not even going to get into that.
Yeah, yeah, we don't have to get into the whole thing. As far as I know, her victim did get away from her eventually, but it's not unusual for, especially when you're abused that young, for it to kind of take a while for it to really like click. So, I mean, in this particular instance, she had his child and they were married, but I think when he got to be in his early 20s or something, he kind of like, it clicked in there for him and he was like, oh.
They made a movie about it recently. With Natalie Portman and
that May December.
Yeah. Not a direct like biopic, but obviously it's that story. So
yeah. Anyway, female abusers towards boys is not unheard of. And, you know, that's what really happened. And as folks mentioned, the woman that would have abused Hikaru when he was 11, she's also dead because her husband, you know, it was a murder-suicide. And we don't know what caused the murder-suicide. It could possibly be because he found out his wife, I'm not going to say cheated, because that's different than what that it was, right? Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, that could be the cause of that. All of it, really dark, awful stuff. And then in the meantime, we have Ruby. So do you feel like this is like a natural character turn for her? Or does this feel more like a, we need some more drama, so now Ruby's just going to start getting up to stuff?
So here is, and I feel like I've been saying this a lot more lately. I want to put it on the record. I like Oshinoko. I think it was an entertaining show. I enjoyed catching up with it. I really liked the cosplay episode just because I thought it was an interesting glimpse.
Yeah, that was an interesting episode.
Who was, I don't think it was it Daryl Surratt? Someone on Blue Sky that is in our circles was posting on Blue Sky about how much Japan has changed when it comes to like the very, very much like hard swing towards acknowledging like sexual harassment, workplace harassment.
Yeah.
Like that's become a huge kind of talking point throughout all of the culture. Like not in a bad way, but just in like a, it's very different from how it was 10 years ago way.
Yeah.
I love it when Oshinoko explores those angles of real Japanese culture and not just like the fantasy sci-fi genre stuff that we usually see. I think that's really cool. But to your point, Lindsay, the thing in this run of episodes, especially because we don't have the anchoring thread of the, what's it called? The manga play thing. We don't have that like through line to kind of ground everything. I keep getting reminded at how often characters almost on a whim are either created or take turns to just become like plot lightning rods, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm thinking of like the director who like sat down and had a weirdly polite and upfront and sweet attempt at seducing like a teenager. He was like, oh,
yeah,
no.
Yeah, we got to talk about that too.
I totally want to seduce you, but I want you to know that it will be purely consensual. I respect women quite a bit. I'm also for fair wages, and I think unionizing would be really good for the industry. And he goes on this like 5-minute monologue about all of the ills of Japan studio filmmaking production pipeline.
Did and I'm like, no. Joss Whedon coded to you?
Maybe. I was more just distracted by like, this guy had a whole lecture prepared.
Yeah.
He has like a symposium of like, well, here's everything wrong with my, here's the Wikipedia dive that the author went on. And
yeah.
I'm going to present it all to you. And I feel like Ruby's almost the dramatic version of that, where it's like, we need to show how you can only really succeed in this industry by becoming a sociopathic scheming manipulator.
Yeah.
Even if it really feels like the character got possessed by like a body snatcher.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really understand why Ruby's taken this like cutthroat industry edge to her at this point. Earlier in chat, Andrew NOS Anime said that it builds on what happened to her at the end of season two, and maybe I'm just blanking because I didn't just watch the finale of season two.
What did she do? Was it she? I mean, she found out about the like revenge thing, right? Like she found out about Aqua. Yeah, I mean,
she always knew about that, but maybe
did she something to do with her like learning more about the dark side of the industry or something.
Yeah.
And she was like committed to doing her part. It's been a while for me too.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's kind of similar to Akane being like, yeah, whenever I do manipulative evil stuff, it's because the character of I that I played or focused on is still inside of me. Like remember when she started doing all that research on I.
Oh, right. She found Dr. Aqua's corpse.
What?
Remember how Aqua was a OBGYN?
Yes.
And then he died and got babified. She found his body. And so I guess she learned about his being murdered.
Oh, I don't remember that at all. Okay. Okay. His corpse is still there?
I think it was hidden.
Well, I mean, it's like on a cliffside, so I can understand it not being like out.
No, didn't they like not find it? Wasn't like they went to the cliff and it wasn't there and they were like, oh, huh, that's weird.
I don't remember.
I can't remember either. She kind of liked the doctor.
Before. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because they both liked I. So I didn't know that they also aren't aware of each other's reincarnated identities.
Oh, they didn't know that?
I don't know. I don't remember. Oh. Wait. He had crawled into a cave and died.
Okay.
I think a crow grabbed the body and hit him in a cave. That doesn't make sense. He's an adult male. His body's too big for a crow to be moving it. So yeah, the body was in a cave. Okay. I mean, I knew he fell off a cliff and maybe there's like a, you know.
They've never brought it up with each other. Oh my God. Okay. For some reason, I didn't really connect the idea that they didn't know.
That like she was the patient and that he was the doctor.
Yeah. For some reason in my brain, they like figure that out really early. Or maybe it's just because we knew.
Yeah. I think it must be just because we knew because Andrew NOS Anime says they know they are reincarnated, but they haven't dug into each other's past. What are you doing? The first thing that happens, me and my brother are like twins growing up and we're like, I'm reincarnated. No, I'm reincarnated. It's that you figure out who you were and you just like talk that. But I guess that kills some of the mystery.
They mutually agreed not. Okay, I guess. All right. So I guess it's because she's in love with him.
I think that's something we all know from the manga, and I don't think that that's been telegraphed yet. They just know they're both huge I fans. Aqua and Ruby are too embarrassed to tell who they are. Aqua is a grown-ass man. Anyway, yeah, I knew Ruby loved the doctor, and that was...
Yeah, so like, yeah. So now that she knows he's the doctor, she's willing to go to any length to avenge him?
Possibly.
I guess? I don't know. It feels weird.
It does feel a little weird. But I want to go back to Kana's casting couch situation that happened there. So... That's what it was. For all of his talk, he was definitely like, this is an exchange. Like, that was, he was upfront.
It was. And no, that's what made it so weird.
I can launch your career. I can get you what you want. Don't have to do anything. But if you want to lay down on the couch and get smoochy and such, we can do that, right? That was funny to me in particular. I don't know if they have the same thing going on, and I'm sure they do. But American entertainment industry, you know, this is sort of still a fresh thing, right? Like, we had the Harvey Weinstein stuff that came out as far as those kinds of casting couches. But we got Blake Lively going to trial with Baldoni over similar sorts of things. I don't think it was a casting couch situation, but it was a sexual harassment on set situation. We had Johnny Depp and Amber Heard case as well. So, I mean, there's just been, you know, this stuff is still happening. And so when he had his, no, don't worry, I'm one of the good ones, like, situation, I'm like, no, you're still not.
Yeah.
Still not. Kana is, it was established, she is still a minor, right? She may be 18.
She might be 18, but they're,
she's
like,
under, she's... drinking age, which in Japan is 20.
Yeah. Wait, no. Didn't it say, it said at some point, Aqua and Ruby are first year high school students, right?
Yeah.
So they are the American equivalent of sophomores. And mm-hmm. aren't Kana and the others a year older than them? Aren't they second year?
Kana goes to school. I really don't think Kana goes
to school. Okay.
She's 18. Yeah. Okay. She may have been older than Aqua anyway. Okay. Aqua and Ruby are 17 now, and Akane and Kana are 18. So yeah, because, you know, there was a point where she's, you know, hanging out with her sort of like barfly friend, and she's not drinking deliberately because if she got caught in that situation, it could hurt her career.
Right.
And I mean, again, even with him being like, you know, you don't have to or whatever, she was set up though. So like, that friend she was hanging out with is finding girls for him, because, you know, she's kind of led on through these meetings, and they meet at the bar and then they drink. And then when she thought her friend was going to show up at that apartment, and she didn't deliberately, because you see her text him.
An interesting running theme in these episodes, because in the cosplay episode, I mean, first of all, we learned that, again, Ruby is a total sociopath and engineered all of this controversy just to give herself a boost. And she doesn't care about any of these people, which is interesting, but also makes her less likable. But there's the one exchange that stuck out to me was when they were talking to the manga artist, the one who made the Tokyo Blade or whatever it's called.
Yeah, yeah.
And the manga artist talked about how she finds it especially skeezy that whenever people try to come and like get approval to license or to market things with like especially like skeevy porn adjacent elements, they always send women. They send women to like try to pitch the sexy bikini or the half naked body pillow.
That's very funny, because I can relate to it like a little bit. But
because people in the industry know that a woman is more likely to trust another woman when it comes to those issues. And I feel like that's very much exactly what's happening in this situation where, I mean, every Epstein needs a Maxwell, right? That's how this happens. A young girl or a younger girl or any girl that is being, you know, has been selected is probably more likely to come to that dinner if they think that they're going to have... you know, a
woman there who will be their escape route or something if it happens. And then it turns out that she doesn't show up or something, which is what happens to Kana. So I feel like, you know, she was misled to be in that situation. She feels in the moment like, I can make this choice for my career. It's not a big deal, yada, yada, yada. You know, this is just how the industry works. But then, you know, when it all comes down, she just starts crying, and she says it's because she likes somebody, which, you know, she does. She likes Aqua. I don't really think that's why. I think if you put a lot of people in that kind of situation, even if they feel like they've made internally like peace with going through with it, or talk themselves about how they're actually in control and it's okay, it's still some random dude.
Well, it's still a power imbalance, right?
Yeah, it's a power imbalance. You feel bad about yourself because, you know, you had to resort to something you didn't think you would need to do because you believed in your own talent. Whether you want to look at this guy as a stepping stone or not for a greater career, it's still like, How did I get here?
It's the definition of objectification. And again, like, there are ways in which people are more than welcome to objectify themselves. And I believe in sex work, right? Like, people are allowed to commodify themselves if that is something that they want to do. But it's different when we're talking about a simple and straightforward exchange of services and compensation versus an industry that has been orchestrated to benefit one group of people more than the other. Because the director's not giving anything up. That's the difference.
Yeah, no.
He could give that role to her because she's good. It's not like he's paying her money because she is a sex worker and saying, this is the exchange you're making. He's saying, I could give you this role because you're talented and you earned it and I think you would be good in the part, but I'm not going to because I know I can also make you have sex with me. That's
even if she went through with it too. There's no contract. It's not like she could turn around and then if he doesn't give her the role, go to his manager, producer, whatever, and be like, but he said if I slept with him, like, you don't have any recourse at all. That's part of the power imbalance involved in that, is that she's still beholden to what he claims he will do. Whether he does it or not is entirely up to him.
And that's another thing, right? Like, in legalized regulated sex work, there is a contract, right?
Yeah.
There's a terms of service. You know, you pay this money, you get this thing. But in these backroom handshake deals, you know, it doesn't matter if it's sexual favors or personal favors or just stringing someone along. It's all the same fundamental type of imbalance. It's just that, as the show points out, that type of imbalance tends to get much more magnified and much more easy for society to accept when it's men in power and young women who don't have power.
Yeah. And like, the reason I brought up Whedon and Baldoni is because they were both self-stylized feminists. Mm-hmm. So like, both in their writing and in how they presented themselves to audiences and people that they worked with. And then it still turned into a different kind. I don't believe Whedon was
a casting couch. He just kind of cheated on his wife and was a dick.
I think he was an asshole on set. I think he was actually like verbally like abusive to women and cast members on set. So as far as like, I remember there being comments towards one of the actresses once she became pregnant about her weight and her body, like screaming matches at people. Like, he was just behaving like a volatile child, but making for an unsafe workplace. Like, if you think your boss or whatever is going to scream at you, you know, you can't show up to work like that. People give a lot of leeway to those sorts of things because it turns into this whole like, oh, well, you know, the genius mythos, you know, the volatile.
Suffering makes the art better.
Yeah. So this guy behaves that way, but that's just because, you know, he's
a tortured genius.
Yeah. You just got to tolerate it because everything he makes is money at the box office, that kind of thing. Whereas Baldoni, though, was legit like sexual harassment sort of stuff on set. Yeah. Auteur, the whole auteur myth. Thanks, LFR. Anyway, I came away from that exchange with, you know, once the casting couch thing came out in Oshinoko, I came away from that like, that guy's full of shit. This is a lot of stuff he says. And I'm sure it's impressive to a lot of young women to feel like he cares about them and about their careers and about, you know, he's not your average kind of director. He's in it for like real professional art and stuff like that.
I can only work with someone if I'm interested in them.
If I'm interested in
them. That's a skill issue, bro. That means you're a shitty director. Like, if you can only work with people you're horny for, that means that you suck at your job.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I do like how Oshinoko kind of touches on these issues in like a really frank sort of way with Kana. Also, I mean, with Ruby's whole cosplay scenario that you're talking about earlier, the short version of that is it's a variety program where they investigate things. I've seen, again, Japanese programs that are very like this, where there's a reporter on the street, but most of it's very like tongue-in-cheek silly to get reactions out of random people and things like that. But in this case, it's Comic-Cats coming up, and so they want to interview voice actors. And so we get the suffering PA, you know, give that guy a hand. He is covering up all the shortcomings of this washed up director who got pushed out for being a pain in the butt. Highly relatable man, to be honest. Just trying to make things work at the whims of people who are not dotting their I's and crossing their T's, basically. But they get four cosplayers, and one of them is primarily an adult cosplayer. She does pinup and nudes and stuff. She's kind of like an OnlyFans model sort of deal, which is what the director wanted because he wanted salaciousness. And then sits her down and just asks her some of the most absurdly inappropriate questions. In fairness, the model kind of takes it on on the chin afterwards. She's like, if you had told me this was going to be that kind of thing and I had been prepared, that would be one thing. But they just caught her on the fly. Yeah.
And she also says, it would have been one thing if I thought you respected me. She says, I'm an adult. I do adult stuff. I can talk like that with my friends.
Yeah.
But when I feel like you're talking to me like that because you think I'm trash. And she made a point to say, and the whole thing about my costume, Ruby implies that she's known for kind of blowing up at people whenever she gets mad. But she makes a point where she's like, you asked me to put all of this work into this really difficult project.
Yeah.
And then at the last minute you said, oh, just actually, we need you to do something else because we couldn't get the rights. You didn't think about me at all. Like, I don't matter to you. I'm just meat, garden variety, minimum wage labor that you can exploit. And that combined with the super salacious questions made it super clear that like, you could give a shit about me.
Yeah. Why am I even here? I can relate to what that feels like, putting a lot of time and work into a project and then somewhere down the line someone dropped a ball and then finding out maybe you didn't even need to do any of that. It sucks. I don't know how many people in here have like had that direct sort of experience, but it sucks. It does make you feel very much like, why am I the only one who's paying attention? Or why am I the only one who cares about this? If you don't care about this, why am I putting in all this effort? So I could really relate to her in that sense too. What did you think of the director apology where they had him put on the sad costume he made? Was that
costume? It's tricky.
Yeah.
Again, with Oshinoko, it's so weird because like on the one hand, it is this genuinely kind of sweet moment where this admitted, crusty, old school, unapologetic guy, you know, a guy who says, look, it's really nice that people can get away with making wholesome, friendly content that makes money. But I was given this job and we're given this meager budget and this meager workload because the network that we work for knows that we're going to make the bare minimum of money by being crass and being vulgar and basically giving people what they can't find on other more wholesome channels.
Yeah, that was an interesting, like, reveal, like when he confronted the PA who's like, listen, dude, we're on the internet as a web stream because they expect us to do what we're not supposed to do. Like there's an unspoken expectation of us to be crude.
And he's like, I know people are going to call me a harassing sexist dick, but this is the only job I can get. And if I don't do this, I'm not going to feed my family.
I wonder if that's ever how Adam Carolla felt during that.
Maybe not Adam Carolla, but definitely
Jimmy Kimmel.
Jimmy Kimmel, yeah.
Yeah.
Jimmy Kimmel, I can guarantee you at some point was probably like, oh God, what am I?
We've got women in bikinis on trampolines.
Okay.
And what am I doing?
I think he was actually a really well-written character in that he embodied this like social issue, but in a way that didn't feel like a caricature.
Yeah. Someone who wasn't just a creep because we want to put a creep in here to talk about it.
No, he's like, I'm a creep because the industry wants it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a reason why people watch our show. And it's not because we're nice. It's not because we're super PC. Like, we have to know that or else we're gonna, whatever.
That does make it seem like a weird fit for Ruby, though, right? Because she's deliberately playing this sort of, well, I don't know. She is playing an airhead on purpose. And I'm wondering if that also kind of feeds into it for her to be like the lady who's asking questions, but I don't get it.
Yeah.
You know, she's sort like, of that.
That's so funny. Oh, you guys are so weird.
Yeah.
But it was wholesome when he made his costume and it sucked. Like he did it. He put in the work. He did his best. And Maya was able to say like, you actually did something that shows you respect what I do.
Yeah.
I care about that way more than whatever dumb questions you asked me.
Yeah.
And that was really wholesome. But then you find out that Ruby manufactured the whole thing so that she could get a leg up and steal the PA to be her manager. And it's just like, oh, well, yeah, I guess that is the industry, isn't it?
It was interesting how she took Aqua's advice. It was like, be nice to the PAs because they're eventually going to be coming up as directors and you'll already have established relationships. And her interpretation of that was, F that, I'll just go directly to the directors now because I don't have time or something.
Yeah, she's got to be famous now.
Now, yeah. And it's working for her. I feel bad for Kana as someone who is legitimately talented. Like they did establish that in the earlier seasons, like she's legitimately a good actress. I don't know what the next sort of arc is going to be, but I kind of hope they go back into the acting segment a little bit because I did really actually enjoy everything about them getting ready for the play and like working on the parts and stuff.
Yeah,
like
learning their techniques and figuring. Yeah, season two has been my favorite run of the show so far, just because I love all that behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah, I really liked it too. But I guess next we're just going to find out if Kana's career survives. Scandalous photos of her coming out of
I know.
Yeah.
For me, the only thing that makes this season not quite as much of a hook as season two is, and I feel bad, but I just genuinely am not interested in Aqua. Anytime the show cuts to his whole like murder revenge thing, I'm just like, oh, okay, whatever. But then when we get back to Kana and Akane and even Ruby, I'm like, all right, this is the stuff. And I feel like the industry is already so rotten and so corrupt and so disgusting and bad that it's like more than enough melodrama for this show to handle. And I feel like the potential, the maybe child abuse, maybe father like abuse, murder, suicide, scandal, like that to me is almost a little too much. Yeah. I'm like, I don't really need all this. I want to know what happens to Kana. I want her to get her part. I want her to be okay.
Yeah. Unless Ruby and Aqua have like some sort of coming to God kind of moment, I don't feel like there's a way for that arc to end with either of them being like content.
Yeah.
People. So at this point, it really is sort of rooting for like, oh, you know, I hope Kana makes that okay. I hope Akane finds herself and is able to, you know, with how much empathy and stuff she seems to have, hope she turns out okay.
They should all get regular jobs and just start a podcast, you know?
They should get
regular 9-to-5 jobs where they can be, you know, maybe a little overworked, but sane.
Yeah.
And then they can get all of their entertainment industry stuff out, talking about random stuff on the internet with their friends, and then they'll be fine.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like they handle Aqua's PTSD really well for what it is and how it's depicted in the show. But he's just like, since day one, he's been so morose.
He is so determined and driven. He's thought through everything, and he will hunt down the man that killed his mother, also crush the woman that he loved and then died and then loved again in a completely platonic way before she died. It's just, I think it's too many layers of just
what the fuckery.
Yeah. Not only has no human literally never been this, he's several people that have never existed that are now smushed together.
Earlier last week after a podcast, I was catching up on Oshinoko specifically, and my husband walked in, and I think he'd seen some random episodes of season one or season two when I was watching it, and he sits down and is like, what's going on? And I'm like, babe,
don't ask.
And then, you know, he always has a lot of follow-up questions, so here I am trying to like sensibly explain the reincarnation character dynamics of Aqua / OBGYN / like fan of I and Ruby, and they're trying to make it all sound normal, and I'm just like, this show is bonkers. Stop making me explain this to people.
This is not entry-level anime. This is not a show that you show like your aunt who, you know, maybe saw an episode of Demon Slayer and thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Wants to know what another cool anime is. Don't show them Oshinoko.
No. Oshinoko's a little bit hard mode. Last Oshinoko point before we call it for the week, but I went out the other day just downtown to like walk the shops. There are a lot of small businesses down there. One of them is a record shop. And so I'm just like thumbing through the vinyls, and they had Idol by Yaosobi on vinyl in there randomly. I'm like, this is mine now. And so I went and took it up to the front. The guy was like, we've had this one for a while, and I've been wondering like who it was for, who would end up buying it. And I'm like, well,
there we go.
It's me.
We do have to acknowledge the OP for this season is just off the chain.
Banger, banger, off banger. Never skip. I like the ED too. I like both quite a lot.
The B, what's the idol group's name? Bikomachi?
Bikomachi,
thank you.
Yeah.
The Bikomachi little music video we got at the beginning of the season. I've been watching that.
Yeah.
A lot of fun.
All of it's good. It's good stuff. All right, everybody. That's it for this week. Next week, man, James, maybe we should do Journal of Witch next week because I haven't caught up on that either at all.
That is a show I will gladly binge watch.
Okay. Cool.
I've been needing an excuse to binge watch that one.
I've been needing it as well. So this will make me do it. So next week we'll be back with, we have another interview. We have a couple of interviews through the rest of the podcast of varying types coming up. So look forward to that. And we'll do Journal with Witch and Jujutsu Kaisen. I didn't even watch the latest episode of Jujutsu Kaisen this week, James. Did you?
No.
We'll catch up on that. See what's going on with Yuji and crew next week. So thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next Tuesday. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Want to stay up to date on all things anime? With more than 10 million visitors a month, Anime News Network is the number one source for all things anime news, reviews, previews, interviews, and more. Give us a visit and see what makes us the internet's most trusted anime news source. The ANN
Anime After Show is an official podcast of Anime News Network. The podcast is hosted by Lindsay Loveridge, Jackie Jing, and James Beckett. You can catch us live on YouTube at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. The ANN After Show is produced by Lindsay Loveridge and edited by Kennedy. That's me.